Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now one of our great writers about New York City and the world, Russell Shorto, probably best known for his book about the Dutch influence on New York before the British took over, called The Island at the Center of the World. He's also a New York Times Magazine contributor, and he has a new book called Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom. Welcome to WNYC. Russell, thanks for coming in.
Hey, Brian. Thanks. Great to be with you.
So you wrote in the New Yorker on the day before Donald Trump's inauguration an article called George Washington, Donald Trump, and the End of Humility. You wrote, as George Washington rumbled off from his Virginia estate toward New York and the presidency, far from feeling flush with imminent power, he told his diary that he contemplated the task ahead with a mind oppressed with more anxious and painful sensations than I have words to express, he wrote. What was he worried about that his revolution had wrought?
First of all, can you imagine Trump expressing himself
right?
in anything like that? He was worried, as were many of the others, about what they had gotten themselves into, about the phrase that the idea that they created a republic, but it was up to them, it was up to the people to keep it, to make it function. And I think he was afraid for himself and for the country.
Did you see Hamilton?
With humility. I have not seen Hamilton.
Ah, so I can't ask you about the portrayal of George Washington in that play.
No, I want to see it. I, in part, didn't want to see it while I was working on a book about the Revolution. It's also true, I have to say, that I have a hard time committing to something a year in advance.
You mean buying tickets a year in advance and I'm going to be free on that day.
Yeah.
And what role does George Washington play in the new book?
He's one of six. This is six different people's lives that I wove together. I had this idea years ago, and I'll give you a sense of how long ago I had the idea. I knew I wanted to have one founding father mixed in with people from different walks of life. And I actually, for a time, considered Hamilton as my founding father, figuring that Hamilton didn't get enough attention.
Ha.
So that dates, the origins of this for me. So the idea was six different people, I wanted to have at least one enslaved American. I wanted to have at least one woman, really to give a sense of what it meant to live through this time. And I had this historic sense of what did it feel like to fight for and be willing to die for basic freedoms. And then the irony being, we're kind of feeling that what that's like again. You know, the history has become moved onto the news, the front page of the news.
So George Washington is one of the six. Another is Brotier Furrow, also known as Venture Smith, who was captured from his home in Africa and enslaved on Long Island. Now listeners are thinking, wait, what? Long Island had slaves?
He actually, that's right. There were slaves in New York. There were slaves in New England. He spent most of his life as a slave and then as a free man in Connecticut. He was for a time on Fisher's Island off the coast of Long Island in his teen years. And then he spent most of his life in Connecticut. And that part of Connecticut, that was in Rhode Island, that was a slave coast. You know, it was not slavery in the same kind or the same degree as it was in the South, but they were slaves working a different kind of plantation. And ironically, they were serving slavery in the Caribbean. They were growing, they were typically herding animals and that would be slaughtered and used to feed slaves and support the whole industry.
And during the period of the Revolutionary War, you write, Venture Smith waged his own effort to buy his freedom and that of his family's, his whole family from the slave owners. What did that process look like? As a slave, how would he have come up with the money to buy his own freedom?
First of all, it was pretty unusual to do that. He had this idea to buy himself and his family out of slavery. The interesting thing about that to me is that he's getting this idea and then carrying it out while, you know, you have the Stamp Act, the Townsend duties, all these things, this drum roll from the 1760s into the 1770s with white Americans clamoring about freedom. And there were those who were clamoring for abolition of slavery as well. Venture Smith, by virtue of this action of his, seems not to have trusted, with good reason, that this eventual freedom was going to apply to him. So you ask, how does it work? He was very cagey, and he was a very good, loyal, hardworking slave. He believed he had this kind of honor code, because there was slavery where he was from in Africa, and the honor code said if you were on that side of the equation, if you were a slave, then you had to be loyal, but you expected that the owner was going to fulfill his part of the bargain and behave honorably. So he got himself an owner who agreed to let him work in the early mornings and at night on his own, and he farmed and he fished for eels and he chopped wood and he saved money.
My guest is the historian and New York Times Magazine contributor who you've also probably seen in The New Yorker, if you read The New Yorker, in recent years, now the author of Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom, Russell Shorto. And as New Yorkers prepare to vote today, we keep mentioning that there are three referendums on the other side of the ballot from where the candidates appear this year, one of which is on whether or not New York should hold a constitutional convention, a state constitutional convention. And one of the other six characters in your book is Abraham Yates, a cobbler turned politician who helped our state transition from the Revolution into the early days of the Republic. In fact, he was tasked with drafting the first New York state constitution, which, by the way, he was against.
He wasn't against the New York state constitution. He was against a federal constitution,
the
U.S.
federal
constitution.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
he helped
to draft the New York state constitution, and they did it in 1776 while he's communicating with General Washington in Manhattan. The constitutional body was running around. They were either in Kingston or Fishkill. They're moving around to avoid the British. So they're doing all this war work. They're sending troops, they're finding cannons, and they're sitting down saying, wait, we have to create a foundation here. We need a state government. And he was pushing for a Bill of Rights. He believed in the state and in creating he was one of the earliest Americans to one of the first to look at the writings, for example, of John Locke and look at this historic precedent for, you know, enshrining the concept of individual freedoms and a republic in a founding document. So he very much believed that for New York, but he found it problematic when it came to a national government.
Because he was more for a decentralized government, so he didn't want any federal government?
He was one of the leading anti-federalist voices who, you know, he was a very prolific writer, wrote essays against the idea of a constitution. They were afraid of power and of elites. He was born, the ninth child of a blacksmith. He was had to apprentice as a shoemaker. He worked his way up laboriously in local politics in Albany. And he firmly believed from very early on that elites were always a danger. And the moment the revolution was won, he basically turned on Washington and Hamilton and the others, particularly Hamilton, who he knew well, and they despised each other, for their, as he saw it, they were overthrowing a foreign elite and replacing it with an oppressive domestic elite. And that's what, and you know, the Anti-Federalists were mostly working class, they were farmers, and you know, they say history repeats, or maybe more likely it echoes. Abraham Yates is one of those who created this echo that is still very much with us.
I'm curious how you think, having looked at the idea of individual liberty so much for this book, how you think it's changed over time. What did it mean in 1776 compared to the way it's used today, which seems to be on the sort of conservative side of the political divide, where if you say I'm for individual freedom, you know, it means you're probably against social programs of various kinds, whether it's healthcare or subsidized student loans or whatever it might be. Did you think about how that notion evolved over time from a meaning at the moment of the revolution to its meaning today?
It continues to evolve, and it's such a broad concept that it means different things to different people at that time and in our time. You can be a, you know, conservative or a liberal in our time and genuinely hold your feelings and your beliefs about what it means. What I think is worth noting and keeping in mind with the, in terms of the American Revolution and its ideals is that it was one manifestation of this vast stream coming out of Europe that had been building for a century and a half that started with people, you know, peering into microscopes and telescopes and realizing that, wait, received wisdom from the Bible isn't necessarily truth, and creating a new theory of knowledge, and it's based on reason, and somehow reason is this thing that connects mysteriously to nature and the universe, and because every human being has this, that means that every human being is equally valuable. And then people very quickly said, well, if that's the case, then that means the only system of government that's valid is one in which each person gets the same say in the government.
Or each white male landholder.
Well, yeah, there are all these qualifications that come into play. But that was the ideal. And what the founding fathers did was they channeled this energy, and they focused one piece of it, which was political freedom. But the whole idea of all men are created equal, they were expressing this broader notion, which, you know, I think that the American Revolution was a promise of freedom, and it was only partially fulfilled with the revolution.
It actually came up on the show recently, the question whether all men are created equal was just the way people spoke about human beings then, so men meant all people, or did they really mean all men are created equal and women are considered less than equal?
I think it's probably both, if that's possible. The French Revolution happened not long after the American Revolution, and when the British writer Mary Wollstonecraft wrote her Vindication of the Rights of a Woman, which was right in that period in between, she is looking at, in particular, French writers who were writing and commenting about freedom. And they were very specifically qualifying it, saying, well, men's freedom and women's freedom are different because women are free within their sphere. And so there was that. That was a very prevalent notion at the time. On the other hand, it's also true that all men at the time meant individuals.
We'll continue in a minute with Russell Shorto, his new book, Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we talk with historian and New York Times Magazine contributor Russell Shorto. His new book is Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom, which is really kind of the story of the American Revolution told through six biographies. We might have time for a call or two for Russell Shorto if anybody has one based on what he's been saying. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Does this connect to today, or is this history that we should know? Well, for one thing, you know, you're a great writer and the book is really fun to read, but also because we should know history. Or does it connect to today?
When I started writing it, I thought I was writing history. I thought these issues were settled. But in the past year, as I was completing it, because you're really kind of completing the book almost a year before it comes out, everything kind of turned on its head. And I'd been knee deep in these documents of the period. And suddenly people at that time were turning back to them, you know, because suddenly it seems like freedom of speech, freedom of the press. I mean, these things are actually up for grabs. It's possible to attack them and get away with it. And so people are kind of returning to this moment in these documents to see what are our foundations actually. And Abraham Yates was one who was really afraid. One of the things he was afraid of with the Constitution was, he said, look at the way it's written in the office of the president. If the president can get the Senate on his side, then he can stack the Supreme Court with people he wants, and he can become a dictator, you know? Mm-hmm. So these echoes from 240 years ago or so, it's still with us, and it's still very much, you know, and I think at different times in American history, you suddenly feel it. You go from feeling, okay, that's the past and it's settled, to suddenly feeling it's with us and we're still having to fight this.
You wrote a book about the Dutch influence on New York. You wrote a book about Amsterdam, living there for 6 years. And in 2014, you wrote, "A cultural conundrum that I struggled to comprehend during my 6 years of living in Amsterdam concerned the Dutch attitude toward celebrities. Do they relate to celebrities differently from Americans?"
You're pulling something that I wrote from a few years ago. Now it's hard to know what the context was. The Dutch are they have this kind of equality. When I lived in Amsterdam, the mayor of the city shopped at the same grocery store, and he would be in line with his soup with his cart, and nobody would, some people would say hi, but it was, they have this, like, don't make a big deal out of it.
Yeah, and that was the sense that I got from that piece, that people were blasé about celebrities.
They don't like the idea of being too, anybody being sort of too highfalutin. There's a saying in Dutch, something to the effect that if you stick up like a nail, you get whacked down.
I guess it made me wonder if the Dutch relationship with celebrities would make them any more immune to electing someone like Donald Trump.
I think that the system there relates to what you're talking about. They have a multi-party system. There are 10 or 11 main parties, and you always end up with a coalition government. And that means, the Dutch system relates back to their battle against water and building dams and dikes to keep the water out. And that meant collaboration, everybody sitting around the table to make sure the village would stay dry. And that's called the polder model. And that's reflected in the system of government today. And that means you distrust majority rule, and it means everyone gets a say. And it typically means no one is happy with whatever the result is, but everyone feels like they're contributing.
Colin in Rumson, you're on WNYC. Hi, Colin.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for this very interesting presentation. My question has to do with the origins of the Second Amendment. Mr. Shorter has talked eloquently about the significance of federal power and the concern that the states, and I've read this elsewhere as well, the states maintain some independence and authority of their own. So in the wording and origin of the Second Amendment, was the original intent to ensure state rights or
individual
rights? Is it really about individual rights?
Yes. Did you look into this?
Yeah, I think that it's, this goes back to what I was saying about the people, not just the leaders at the time, not just the elite, but everyone in different ways, was aware of living in a time in which this talk of freedom and individual freedom was in the air. I mean, even at the same moment that they were fighting for independence, husbands and wives were beginning to relate to each other differently. Obviously, the question of slavery was being focused more. So there was this huge attention on individual rights. And people like Abraham Yates, who we were talking about, this anti-federalist, the reason that they were pushing for a Bill of Rights, and Yates, by the way, even the Bill of Rights wasn't good enough for him, but it had to do with individual rights. I think the two things are, you can't separate them. They were concerned about individuals, and they were concerned that the states, vis-a-vis the federal government, have their rights.
At that time, when there was no such thing as the National Guard, and the guns in question were muskets, I wonder how any of the founding fathers would feel knowing that today we have AR-15s, but there's no way to know.
I think that's an impossible question to answer. I think you're going to answer that based on your inclinations right now.
I want to get to one other thing, which is one of the other six characters in the book, a Seneca tribal leader known to Americans as Corn Planter. Was there anything in it for Native Americans that they saw in the American Revolution against the British?
They tried to stay out of it. And initially, both the Americans and the British wanted them to stay out of it. They were hoping it would go away and they would be left in peace. The British ultimately cajoled and bribed them into siding with them. And they did, and they fought in Corn Planter, who was against doing so once they voted in favor of it, fought and led them in these murderous attacks on Americans. And then the irony in his life is that after the British and therefore the Iroquois lost, the Iroquois appointed him to be the one to negotiate with the Americans. So he, who had never wanted to get into this war, now had to go to the Americans and say, look, what can we do about this? And they said, in essence, they said, you lost, too bad. And so then he spends the rest of his life really trying to make a decent deal for his people.
And we have to leave it there with Russell Shorto, historian, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, and the author now of Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hope you'll join me again tonight when I'll be here to anchor our election coverage that begins at 8 o'clock tonight on both AM and FM, WNYC. And of course, if you're anywhere else, you can always stream it online at WNYC.org. In the meantime, if you still need voting information, still deciding on anything, we have a great voter's guide on our website at WNYC.org. Hope you all vote and talk to you tonight.